What is the top advice you would give for an wannabe author?
I think a good story is poetry to me is about.
Welcome to Living a Life Through Books, the podcast about everything bookish. I'm your host, Dr. Shanaz Ahmed, and today we have author conversations. It's a really, really, really interesting story how Christina Baker Klein happened to come on my podcast. Yeah, we talk about that. And before I get to our conversation, once again, just want to remind you guys, look at the show notes. Please, 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 there are ways to support me. There's Buy Me a Coffee, Libro FM, all of that. Your support means everything to me, keeps this podcast going, all that good stuff. And now, without further ado, here's Author Conversations with Christina Baker Klein. Christina Baker Klein, welcome to the Living a Life Through Books podcast. I am excited to have you here. And I'm really intrigued, first of all, about the whole thing about the Google alert, because that's how we met.
So crazy.
Yeah, we did your book as in my podcast as a book club. So tell me about that. Like, I want to know what I didn't see. Like, you get this Google alert, and then what do you think? What are you thinking? What are your feelings? Because it's almost like I would think it's like a review or something. Oh my God, what did they say about me? You know?
So well, I just have a long-standing Google alert for my name. I didn't even set it up. I think some assistant I had one time set it up. And so I get Google alerts, you know, every day. And when they are interesting to me, as yours was, I send them along to my assistant, who then will like do a little post or a story or something. And she's like, yeah, let's share this podcast. That sounds really fun. So that was how it happened.
Oh, wow.
I'm not good at doing those stories myself, but I love to like draw attention to people who are reading my books if possible, and also to highlight podcasts that I haven't heard about before. So I was really happy to do it. And I'm so grateful to you for choosing my book, which was a big, lovely surprise.
Yay. No, I don't even know how your book got chosen. Actually, it was on my shelf here. And, you know, it's like one of these books. And I just said, what book are we going to pick? And I said, I don't know. Let me pick a book I haven't read that I want to read. And I looked up and I said, you know, we've heard of Orphan Train. We're going to do this. I don't know. I've heard about this book. Let's do it. And wow. So you have been writing since forever, right?
I've been writing for a really long time. Yes. I started publishing books in my 20s. And yeah, I've just been in the business for a long time. I've had lots of other and still do things that keep me busy. I mean, teaching and editing and all of that. Finally, all these years later, I do make a living as a writer, but I also am doing a lot of other things. Like, I'm a judge for a big book prize right now, and I'm chairing a gala committee for the Authors Guild, and I'm on the board of a number of organizations. So I have to be very disciplined with my writing because I kind of get drawn in a lot of directions. I'm teaching in a writing program.
Okay. In a writing program, is it part of a university, college?
Yeah.
How does that work?
So this program is really cool. It's part of Stony Brook University, and it's called Bookends. And it was started by a novelist named Meg Wolitzer, who's pretty famous. And it is, so I think there are 10 or 12 of us novelists who teach in this program, like Paul Harding and Matthew Clam and all these wonderful people Meg teaches. And it's a novel writing program. And so we each mentor a novelist one a year, and we get that novel, so I think there are like 60 to 100 submissions. And out of those, we each end up with one. So there are 12 probably that end up getting chosen. And then we work with our people to revise their novels and help them get them ready to publish or to find an agent. So it's kind of a work intensive program for us, the mentors, because, you know, you're working very closely with someone, you're working sort of like a book editor with them to see how to help them. But it's also an amazing program. It's innovative in that the novelists who get in then have what they call pods, and there are groups of them who meet, who are working on novels. So it's not just the mentor who's working with them. They all also work together. So it's really innovative and creative and fun to be a part of. So I'm really glad to be involved with Bookends.
So with Bookends, it's not really an MFA or anything.
Right. It's a non-degree program. And a lot of our people already have MFAs. Wow. Some of them teach already. Some of them even have published novels already. But most of them are emerging writers who are trying to get their first books published. And so the program is just more hands-on than anything. In fact, if I had it to do, well, I guess the thing about an MFA is that you then get sort of qualified to teach at the college level, which I've done for many years. But
right.
If I weren't worried about that, if I didn't need the degree, a program like this is in some ways much more practical because it's really working with you to get a book into shape. So
Right. And I'm guessing it's a paid program and all of that, right?
That's right. But there are serious scholarships. And in fact, Stony Brook just received a big donation for more scholarships for these students. So we have some who are sort of on a sliding scale of, you know, some are coming for free and some are paying some and some are paying the whole amount. So it's a really cool program. I would suggest that if people are working on novels, they might want to look into it.
I will definitely look into it. I am actually working on a novel. I don't even know what draft I'm on, but
Yeah, you might consider doing that, actually. Mm-hmm. It's really exciting. And the other thing about it that if I had had something like this as an MFA student, it would have been, I think, incredible. You just get so much access to a whole bunch of published writers because everyone on this faculty is interested in your work and we're all cheering each other's people on. So, you know, I've blurbed books of people who have graduated from the program who weren't my writers, but were other people's writers. And it's just a lovely community that way. And the people who graduate then stay engaged in the community too. And so when we get together in person and on Zoom, they often are a part of it.
What is the top advice that you would give a writer before they join the program, when they're in the program? You know, what is the top advice you would give for a wannabe author?
Oh my God, I think it really depends on where you're at in the process. The biggest advice I give my students who are starting novels is that you have to finish the novel before you know what you've got, right?
Sure.
That's self-evident, but a lot of people give up too soon and they don't actually finish. You know, they think that it's insurmountable at some point. There's often a stage, for me, it's around page 120 when I just think, I don't know if I have enough. I don't know if I can pull this off, or I don't know if I know enough, or I don't know if I have enough, or I don't know if it's interesting. And I get very filled with self-doubt. I think you have to push through that phase and get to the end. And then the other advice is don't give up. Don't stop too soon. Most novels need serious revision. And sometimes people submit things before they're ready, and then they don't get another shot with that person, either an agent or a publisher. So it's really important that the book is as finished as it can be before you submit it to contests and to, you know, agents and things like that. I think people do it much too quickly and want to get it off their desk instead of letting it percolate long enough to really see what it's needed.
Right.
In the manuscript.
But so how does
two pieces of advice.
But how does someone know? You know, when you're writing, you know, you write the best you can. You're like, I've gotten to this point. How do you know that, you know what, I'm going to put it away. I'm going to let it percolate.
Yeah.
Or no, this is ready to go.
Well, first of all, let me ask you this. So with your own work, for example, when you're finishing a draft, then here are some little tips that you may have done, that you may do, but do you try a different font and read it in a different font and revise it that way? Or do you change the size? Like sometimes, or the layout, meaning sometimes I will just do things single spaced, Calibri font, which I won't use in the final submission, but I want to see it a different way. Sometimes you have to jolt yourself into seeing your manuscript differently.
Oh, wow. And okay. I have not done that.
This is something that Meg Wallacer does as well. She uses a different font. Another thing that I do is I will revise. So I write longhand, actually.
Okay.
And then my second draft is typing it in, which is a big revision for me. And then I have my third draft that really needs a major revision. So I do that. I type it in. Then I revise on the page, on the screen. Then I print it off and have another whole revision that is printed. So, and then I get those in and I put those all in and I print it off again. I mean, I just do it. I have a lot of drafts and it takes a lot of time, but I think that's what I need for the prose to really be clean and to feel like it's as good as I can make it. Mm-hmm. Every time I read it, I find something new. And this is true of my published books too. Mm-hmm. I don't like to reread my published books because I get in there and I want to edit them.
Can we do Orphan Train part two?
Actually, I did do that. I don't know which version you have of Orphan Train, but I went back 3 years late. My publisher, when I said I wanted to add a scene that people were asking for, they said, there's no way that will never happen. But I the book then did very well. And so they gave me the opportunity to add a scene. And when I did that, I said, do you mind if I go through and re-edit the whole novel? Yeah, you're going to show me whether you have it. Let's see. That version, I think you have the original. Yeah, that is not the added scene, I'm pretty sure. So I went back and I wrote a scene that doesn't appear or that is extended from that. And if you are curious about it, you can go to the Orphan Train page on Amazon or you can go to my website and download it for free. It's just about 10 or 12 pages. But anyway, when I did that, I revised the whole book. They said, knock yourself out. And I did. I went through and I revised it.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
So I actually have two versions of Orphan Train out there. So you can see I'm quite serious about this revision thing.
Right. So, I mean, me, I'm a first-time author, just been dabbling in writing since I was like 25. I've been like started writing when I was 13, just dabbling. I'm like, I'm going to write a book. I'm just writing and then stopping and writing and stopping in life. And this book, the one I've actually finished and gone through, like, I don't even know, 6 or 7 revisions. I like finished the book, put it away for 6 weeks, like Stephen King says on writing.
Yes.
Put it away, picked it up again. It was all like jumbled. I'm like, nope, the scene, cut, delete, cut, delete. Like I was just like cut, deleting, like there was no tomorrow. Put it together. I'm like, nope, I don't like this character. I don't like the scene. Okay, let's move. Nope, we'll move this. And I moved everything over, got it polished as best as I could. And then I had some people read, like, I think the first 2 or 3 chapters.
Yeah.
Helping edit it because I wanted to submit for some contest, which you're like saying, you shouldn't have done that. You should have waited. But anyway, no, which is fine, which is fine. And I did that. Then I went to a writing conference, retreat, whatever you want to call those. And one of the advices given to me was to actually pay and hire an editor.
Yes.
So I did that and I got these notes. It's 5 pages of notes, just like, you know, character, blah, 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 plot, you know, try.
Were they useful to you?
They were useful. They were
useful. On target?
Yes.
Okay. Yes.
I felt they were on target. I felt that what the editor said did not really, let's say, change my story. It sharpened it. Mm-hmm. It just got a better focus. It's like, okay, I really like this scene. If you can make this scene kind of look like this scene, the more of show, don't tell kind of a thing.
Yeah.
So I did all of that. And that took me a while to edit based on the editing recommendations, because I liked the recommendations.
Yeah.
Now it would have been easy if the recommendations came in and I'm like, nope, 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 nope. It wasn't that. It were all really good recommendations. So I did that. I've had like a couple of people, I think, read the whole book and they've told me some stuff. And I feel like every time someone reads the book, the notes keep decreasing.
Oh, amazing. That's very good, right? Like,
It's less. And just recently, I got notes on the first three chapters, and all they said was anchor the timeline because it's 1990. I need to know, without you mentioning at the top of the chapter 1990, I want to know the year with you anchoring it. Like, what was, you know, top things going on, except this is South India. So I'm kind of Googling what was the top song at that time? What was the top movie at that time? You know, trying to anchor. But anyway, the process of writing, when did you start? When did you start writing? Like, as a child? And when did you know you wanted to be an author? What was your journey like when you first started?
You know, I think that so all children are creative.
Yes.
All children draw and sing and dance and write and make up stories and, you know, act. And then most people grow up and don't do that stuff, right? But some of us keep going. And I think I think the bigger question is, why do most people stop, right? I think most people at some point along the way, they're not encouraged. They may not feel it eventually as they grow up, but a lot of people do feel it. They want to be creative, but they're not sure how. And for some reason, it's just not nurtured in them. I think I was lucky to grow up in a family where my creativity was nurtured. My parents were kind of hippies. They were very creative. They were professors.
That's awesome.
You know, they didn't care about money and they loved reading and they loved poetry. And so I did not come from a family of novelists, but my father was a historian. And as I've gotten older, I've realized that my novels involve a ton of research. And I think I was very influenced by him. My mother was an English literature and women's studies professor. So I think she also influenced me quite a bit. So all of that, the truth is though, I say to my own children that you should follow your passion, but you need to know that your avocation may not be your vocation, that the thing you love may not be the thing that earns you money, and you always need to have a way to make a living. So make sure you have a marketable profession, a marketable trade. And in my case, that was getting qualified, as I said, to teach and to edit. So for many years, I had my own editing business. I edited many clients who came from agents, from publishers, or on their own, kind of like what you were talking about. Mm-hmm. And I have many friends who still do this work. And then I also taught full-time at a number of universities. So I was in that world, and I always assumed that I would, I've never really had trouble getting published, but until Orphan Train, I wasn't making a real living. Even if you get a reasonable advance,
mm-hmm.
over the time it takes to get published,
right,
you know, you still need
right,
to, right. So right. It's, you know, so making a living as a writer alone is, I realize, a very rare thing and a lucky thing. But as I said, I didn't ever assume that I would be able to do that. I always thought that I would spend my life teaching and editing and writing. And so I think that work ethic has actually served me really well. And it also led me to just be pretty determined about it and not to get disappointed and quit because I wasn't relying on it for my single source of income.
Right.
I think if you set your expectations, you know, in a reasonable way, you mm-hmm. can continue to do it if it's what you love to do.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I would love to get published.
Yeah.
But, you know, the journey of finding an agent and, you know, and then selling the book, it's all a learning process.
It's all daunting.
What's that?
I said it's daunting.
It is. What would you advise someone with that?
I mean, I think that the finding an agent is so hard. They are programmed not to want to take people because they already have clients. My advice, and they, you know, a lot, they're inundated with people, and they don't always make the right decision. There are plenty of people who get turned down by one agent and eventually get picked up. There are lots of stories about that. Stephen King tells stories about that.
Mm-hmm.
I think one mistake people make is by feeling like they need to apply to the top agents in the business who are the most in demand and the busiest. My first agent was just starting out. She had been an assistant to an agent and she was taking on new clients. And I had her when she was really young and she was great. I was young too. She was really hungry. So that was important. And so I would say there are, yes, it's hard to get an agent, but there are actually a lot of agents out there and a lot of people starting out and a lot of new agents of color who have really interesting and different kinds of criteria and interests. And I just think it's actually a pretty good time to be a writer. There are also lots of ways to get published that don't require agents. There are a ton of small presses. There are a ton of university presses that are now taking fiction. There are lots of ways to publish that are not even that, that are independent publishing. There's She Writes, which is a hybrid model, which has a great track record for publishing women writers. So, you know, in my world, I see lots of different ways that people do this. But with that said, what you did, which is to go to a writers' conference where there will be agents present, is also a really good thing to do, to meet people in person. Sometimes there's no substitute for that.
It was actually a retreat. I don't think there were any agents. I met Alka Joshi.
Mm.
And
she's great.
She is like, she is such a, like a powerhouse, and she is an advocate
yes.
for women and to elevate women and to help them. So yeah, here I am. So I'm going out. I'm like, she's like, you want to go for a walk? I'm like, sure. Okay. You know, so here yeah. I am. We go for a walk with her and, you know, I'm having ice cream. We're talking about books. And then she told me about getting an editor and all of that. But the one thing I'll remember about going for a walk with her is we're walking, and this is in the streets of New Mexico.
Oh.
And this was the biggest lesson I got, was she says to me, Shanaz, beautiful doors, what are you talking about? Like, you know, in my mind, I'm walking. And then she's like, look there. And she's like, look at those doors. And there were these, I think it was like a workshop, a carpentry, like they'd set the doors outside where it was all carved and it was all these beautiful doors.
Yes.
And I looked, I'm like, wow, beautiful doors. And the message I got was, pay attention, Shanaz. She's an author. She's always paying attention. She's always looking for things to write about potentially, is what I got out of it. She didn't tell me, oh, look, you should pay attention. She didn't say it to me, but that was the message I got there. I was like, beautiful doors. So now I'm always looking for beautiful doors.
That is just wonderful. I think Alka Joshi came, I'm sure she did, to the Kauai Writers Festival. That's another place you might consider coming. It's really wonderful. And, you know, there's a lot of access to agents and editors there. So there's a suggestion for you.
So go to festivals and writing places where there are agents and editors.
Yes. Yeah. And also, as I said, look up agents who may not be, who may be starting out, you know, or just
starting
have
out.
A few clients and are hungry. So a couple suggestions for that. One is there's a resource publishers marketplace, and I think it costs $60 a year. Mm-hmm. But if you pay for it, you get access to their database of agents and you get to see who's done deals and what kind of deals they've done. And you have lists of their clients. Another thing that's changed is that because of the internet, agents now have amazing online presences that they never had when I was starting out. And even until recently, they haven't, there was sort of a secrecy around who they had as clients. And now you can really see all of that on the websites.
Why do you think there was that secrecy in the past?
Well, there was no internet. There was no internet. And so people just, you know, it was sort of like a closed door. If you didn't know people or know the right people, you didn't get to see what was behind the door. But with the internet now, there's a lot more competition. So I think agents really want to present well online. They still might not be that accessible, you know, when you reach out to them, but they are there and you can see what they've, you know, who they represent and what their vibe is. And it's also, it's so helpful to look at agency, you know, to go down a rabbit hole of looking at books you love, reading the acknowledgments, finding out who the agents are, and then, going, you know, and then seeing kind of who that agent represents. There's no substitute for that kind of research. And then in your cover letter, making it personal about who you like, whom they represent.
Right. Like, so, oh, Christina, you represented Alka Joshi for her this, and I really love this element of her book. And my book has these elements too. And I'm hoping you'd like my book because of that. Something like that.
That's right. That's exactly right. For sure. So what is your thought about all these non-traditional ways of publishing? I mean, how are you feeling about those options versus trying to get a, you know, an agent and an editor the old-fashioned way or the big publishing way, which is the five big publishers?
The big five publishers. I'm going to say, you know, obviously the dream is big five. You know, that is an obvious dream. My thought, I'm old school because I'm older. I mean, I'm 52 now. And part of age, you grew up like being kind of telling yourself or being told there's such a thing as traditional publishing, which in my mind, traditional publishing is even the indie presses, the small publisher who you can approach even without an agent, you know, that somehow I feel going that way, you would have potential access to someone else having read your work and being like, hey, let's edit it this way, making it more, I guess, sellable and also making it cleaner if there was something missing. The other element is the total independent publishing, which is like, oh, hey, Christina, I have this draft sitting in my inbox. I'm just going to hit enter on Amazon. And I got a book out today, right now. I don't know, but I feel I'm not a big fan of it. I know there are authors who go the extra mile, who edit the book and who go through all these steps, and then they go publish it that way. Sure.
Yeah.
But there are also, I feel it still has a little bit of a bad taste in my mouth where you have people putting out things that are potentially not up to par.
So then you know what you want, which is to really work with an editor who can help you and shepherd you through. But as I said, I do think that there are lots of smaller places in addition to, for your listeners, there are lots of smaller places that have incredible editors working for them. And I don't think that people should discount those. It's true that the advances are not as big as the big five, but some of the big fives, depending, don't offer that much anyway. And also, once you earn out, you suddenly are making royalties. I have a dear friend who has a fantastic book at Counterpoint, and she's like getting great royalties from it. So
from a smaller press.
Yeah. Counterpoint is a very respectable, wonderful press, smaller press. And she went with them because they offered such hands-on, you know, attention.
Mm-hmm.
She's like, and I get royalty checks. I love it. So
right. And you get royalty checks after you earn out your advance.
That's right.
And you would potentially earn out your advance if it's a smaller advance.
Yes, that's exactly right. You earn out a lot sooner. You earn
lot sooner. If you have a huge advance, you kind of like, when am I ever going to see a royalty check in this lifetime? Am I going to? I hope I am, you know?
Yes, that's true. There are some agents who say that their goal is to get their author enough money that they don't ever earn out, which I think is kind of weird. I love the idea of everyone being happy. Mm-hmm. But I will say, with that said, your publisher earns out a lot sooner than the author does. So the author, it takes a lot of work to earn out if you get a big advance, but the publisher has already made their money back. So,
well, of course. Well, they have to. It's part of the business.
That's right.
What makes a good story?
I think a good story is conflict is the heart of a good story. I think one of the mistakes people make is in thinking that sort of being afraid to put their characters into conflict or in situations of peril or discomfort. And it's really important that your characters dwell in conflict with each other and in excruciating worry, conflict, trouble, internal or external. Otherwise, it's just beautiful writing. Or maybe not even, you know.
Okay. So if it's just beautiful writing, then why should someone buy the book?
Well, I'm saying they shouldn't.
Right? So people buy the story.
People buy books for the story, mostly. With the caveat that I, and probably you, I'm guessing, buy books that are beautifully written. We read for language. I love beautiful writing.
Yes.
But if that beautiful writing isn't connected to a story that grabs me, then I'm just not going to be that interested in it, unless it's poetry.
Right.
And that's a whole different thing. Poetry, to me, is about crystallizing an idea or a feeling, a thought, a fleeting memory that you might not be able to put your finger on, but that someone else is able to articulate for you. It's something, I think poetry dredges up our deepest feelings, if we're lucky, good poetry in my view, and helps us make sense of the world. I think Mary Oliver does that beautifully, helps us make sense of the world and make sense of the way we make our way through the world. Her story, her poems are not, you know, plots, but
right.
They're moments and they're just spectacular. But I think that for a good novel and a good memoir, there must be conflict and a real trial that your central character goes through. And the books that I'm interested are the ones that have some philosophy in them, that they're really about the way people live, the choices they make. I think people in my novels tend to think about what they're going through and then rethink it in ways that I hope are useful to the reader. But also just that if you write a novel, for example, that has two different, the way I did with Orphan Train, has two different perspectives.
Right.
The real challenge is to have people be interested in both of them equally. And usually people are not interested in both equally. They're interested in, you know, depending on their personalities, they're interested in one story or another.
True. So
that job is to just make each story equally compelling and equally exciting. And in Orphan Train, I think the Orphan Train story is one that most people didn't know a lot about, and it's not familiar, and it's also historical. So a number of people probably read the book for that story. And then my job was to try to tell a story in the present day, a contemporary story that felt as compelling. And I don't know if it does, but that was what I set out to do. And that's what I always set out to do, is to try to make sure that people want to turn the pages.
Right. It was compelling. It was, the thing is, anytime you have children who, you know, don't have agency, well, they do, but they don't. It's taken away and they're trying, but they're kids. It's, your heart goes out to them. And the reality is, with times like with Orphan Train, or I don't know if you've heard of the book Before We Were Yours.
Yes.
Yeah, those kind of books, they shine a light on a time in our society when, you know, we took, you know, we used children essentially a certain way. And then you think, oh yeah, we've gotten past that. Now we have this other system, this other supposed system that's working.
Yeah.
That's really not.
Exactly.
Which was really one of the things that was brought up in the book club. I don't know if you heard the whole podcast, but one of the things that was brought up was how you have one character in the foster care system and you have our main character who was in the Orphan Train. And it's just, one person said, it's just a growth of history of how we have historically taken care of
our children who are in trouble, right?
Yeah, children who are in trouble. I mean, which child really is in trouble? That's the question I have. Which child really is in trouble? It's the adults who technically should be the one in trouble by abandoning these children.
That's true. Yes.
There's child is really, I don't know. I mean, but they're in trouble because someone just dumped
them
there.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and it's, as you can see with the present day story of orphan trade, I mean, it's still a huge issue today. Mm-hmm. Of course, it always will be. There will always be children who are not taken care of by the people who should be taking care of them. And then the question is, what happens to them and how does our society handle it? I think that's really the dilemma. And at the time of the orphan trains, there was no social safety net. So there was no way to do it. Even now we may have a social safety net, but it's imperfect and it's very flawed. But what the best we can do then is have organizations that try to help those children. And so, I really firmly believe in and help and am involved with a few of those because it's you've got to have what happens, right? When children through the cracks, it's never good for society.
Right. Of course. Yes. What are three of your top favorite books that are not yours?
You know, I have a short shelf of books that are I love that are kind of my all-time favorites, but then I often have books that I pick up and read while I'm working on specific books. Mm-hmm. And there are books that are not maybe in my top all-time books that I learn things from. I learn tasks from, or I learn techniques from. So I'll give you an example. When I was when I was just starting to work on Orphan Train, part of what I wanted to do was to propel the story forward so that you began each scene really jumping in, not with a lot of throat clearing. Mm-hmm. And I had just read a novel called The Lovely Bones by Alice Sebold. And she does that beautifully. She jumps into each scene, each chapter with kind of both feet running so that you're just off and going. And what I did that was helpful to me is I actually wrote down the first sentence of every new scene in her book. I had a list of like 60 of them. And I just sort of studied it. I was looking at how she uses verbs, how she gets the reader engaged so quickly. And then it really helped me writing that book as I started my sections. I didn't copy anything word for word, but I did.
Of course not. Right.
But I was very inspired and I learned from it. Another book when I was writing Orphan Train that was helpful to me was called Water for Elephants. And the reason it was helpful is that it was a dual narrative that went back and forth between a boy in the early 20th century and someone in the present day and him as an old person in the present day. And when I first did that novel, I conceived of it like that book going quickly back and forth between sections. And in the end, I changed it so that I had 40-page segments because I realized I wanted the reader to kind of fall into the story more and have a little bit more time with each of them. But those books were both very helpful to me in that way with that book. And I find it's true for me with other books as well, that I'll find books that for some reason have some little trick or, you know, idea. But I would say the books that influenced me most as a novelist are some of those big 19th century novels like Madame Bovary is really important to me, Middlemarch, Jane Eyre, and then Anna Karenina, which are all female heroines, right? They're all very complicated, flawed heroines.
Right.
And a lot of them in those stories are about women striving to better themselves or to live in, to kind of pull themselves out of a rough situation. So I think I've done that in my books as well. And then I loved Mrs. Dalloway by Virginia Woolf and the book The Hours by Michael Cunningham. The Hours is a retelling of Mrs. Dalloway, or it sort of jumps off from there, actually. Mm-hmm. And they're both beautifully written, but if you read them, I would suggest that you start with Mrs. Dalloway because it's it was written in the early 20th century, and it's a little more ornate. Mm-hmm. And then you move to The Hours, which you'll see is beautiful and compelling and written in a very contemporary style.
Wow. Thank you.
So yeah, that's what I would say.
That is wonderful. Thank you so much. Is there anything else you'd like to share with my listeners? Because we're kind of, I don't want you to miss your next appointment. So
thank you. I would just say, thank you so much for having me on. You know, I always love to hear from writers. So I hope this has been helpful to someone out there. I do think that we learn from each other, and that one of my biggest takeaways, or one of my biggest sort of pieces of advice ultimately, is to befriend people who are working on creative projects the way you are. There are a lot of people who don't, but if you can find people who are doing something similar to you, you'll find it so sustaining. And if you can find people who read your work, and if you'll find people who can talk about books with you, talk about ideas, talk about how to get an agent, it really helps to have a community of other writers.
Thank you so much, Christina.
Thank you so much. So much. It was great. And good luck with everything.
Thank you so much. Have a good one. Bye.
And that, my friends, was my conversation with Christina Baker Klein. I think it was great. I loved it. Next up for the podcast is another author conversation. It's author Erin Young. She's been on the podcast before, so I was really excited to have her back. That's going to be the next episode. After that, there's book club. And after that, I talk to a bookstore owner. So there's a lot coming up. Stay tuned. And before I go, if you loved this episode or any of my previous episodes, please take a moment to write me a review on Apple Podcasts. Please share this podcast with your family and friends and through your social media channels. Follow me on Facebook and Instagram on Living a Life Through Books. I'm also on Clubhouse. Look me up by name. I'm on TikTok. My tag is at Dr. Shanaz Ahmed. You can reach me through email. My address is livingalifethroughbooks@gmail.com. My website is shanazahmed.com. That is shanazahmed.com. The opening and closing music to this and all my previous episodes was composed by my husband, Brad Slavik. I'm Dr. Shanaz Ahmed with Living a Life Through Books signing off. Remember to water the seeds within you. It's time.